He also understands the value of gold. That's why my Norwegian friend insisted we meet. He asked me if I knew the true value of the U.S. dollar. In his words, the value of the dollar today is a dozen nuclear-powered aircraft carrier battle groups. What he meant was, you take the money as payment, or else. That's eerily similar to what the Romans had. By the 3rd and 4th centuries, soldiers took the bronze coins as payment or faced consequences. Consequences only work for so long. Eventually, the soldiers demanded sound money as payment. Ruling by force is not a position of strength. Any parent knows this. Successful leadership means instilling trust. People trust certainty. Money certainty means creating a standard and sticking to it. Currency debasement is the same throughout history. As the Western Roman Empire cascaded into instability, the Eastern Empire rose. From the 4th century forward, the Byzantine Empire thrived. Its capital, Constantinople, had the power to create coinage just like Rome. At first, its coins held steady value. With a high gold content, citizens trusted the money with their savings. After all, in the early days, it watched money troubles unseat Rome from its dominant position. Eventually, everyone forgets about the last debasement. Enough time passes, people die, nobody remembers the problems of the past. In the 11th century, a money changer named Michael IV, the Paphlagonian, took control of the empire. Within 40 years, the empire's coinage fell from 87.5% pure gold to less than 30%. In the end, a small child could bend Byzantine coins made of flimsy, cheap metal. With its money in crisis, a new emperor took over at the end of the century. He returned the coinage to 90% pure gold. This process repeats through all of history. Governments can't resist. The trick is knowing when the debasement speeds up to an extreme. The first debasement can be wildly profitable for people in the know. Take the Romans, for example. Cutting 5% of silver content from the denarius gave the wealthy a boost at first. Once people caught on, trust faded. At the end, only force compels someone to take the worthless coins. This can and will happen to the U.S. dollar. It won't be the first time. Chapter 4. 1933 Gold Confiscation. My grandfather, G.S. Tucker Jr., taught me about the stock market. The night before he died in 2013, he read a printed copy of my first financial newsletter. It went out to roughly 300,000 paid subscribers. While I'll never know for sure, I sensed, reading that letter, he knew the student had become the teacher. We were very close. We talked about everything, even taboo subjects that the rest of my family wouldn't dare touch. Born in 1919, he lived through an unprecedented period of economic growth. One point of contention in our close relationship was gold. He just didn't see the point. However, he often told me a story from his youth that made a strong argument for it. In 1933, his mother gathered her four children together. At 14, he was the youngest. She had a cigar box filled with gold coins. They were mostly U.S. and European coins from the 18th and 19th centuries. He described the coins in the box, including the one he kept. We estimated the box today would be worth around $1 million, maybe more depending on the rarity and condition of the coins. That was also over a decade ago when gold traded for half its current price. There's a strong argument for holding on to rare gold coins, which we'll discuss later. She told the kids they could each pick one coin to keep as a souvenir. At that time, the official price of gold was $20.67. She called it a souvenir because on March 9, 1933, President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued an executive order declaring gold effectively illegal. Going forward, citizens could keep no more than 5 ounces. All other gold had to be exchanged at any bank for $20.67 an ounce before May 1, 1933. Anyone holding gold after that time faced a fine of $10,000 and 10 years in prison. I asked my grandfather why his mother complied with this. He said his mother felt President Roosevelt asked for the gold because the country needed it. In her mind, defying the order would be an act of treason. She wasn't totally off base. Executive Order 6102 took its legal basis from the 1917 Trading with the Enemy Act. After issuing the order in March 1933, Roosevelt had the country's major newspapers support the action with daily articles about gold hoarders. These speculators put the nation in danger, according to the media drumbeat. It's easy to see why my great-grandmother took the order seriously. How to debase the U.S. dollar. Shortly after confiscating gold from his citizens at a price of $20.67 per ounce, Roosevelt revalued gold to $35 an ounce. To be clear, this means the official value of gold rose 69% by decree. It took that many more dollars to equal the same gold ounce. The value of the gold stayed the same. It's the dollar that lost value. Keep in mind, gold did not trade on the domestic market in the U.S. There was no quote for the gold price as there is today. It had a fixed price of $20.67 per ounce before the 1933 confiscation order. The price was $35 an ounce after the order. After May 1, 1933, it was illegal to own gold outside of a few souvenir ounces. What citizens didn't realize at the time was Roosevelt needed their gold in order to devalue the dollar. This means debase the dollar. As in Roman times, debasement was the only way out for governments in money trouble. 1933 was the official tail end of the Great Depression. The stock market crash of 1929 merely kicked off the economic decline. What people didn't realize was the 1929 crash was a warning to get out and stay out of the market. Over the next few years, people lost their life savings jumping back into the market only to see it fall more. During the Depression years, gold held a fixed value of $20.67. Businesses failed in droves. The U.S. unemployment rate hit 22%. It stayed high. There was no work. With the value of all other assets falling precipitously, gold sat flat. That means the value of $1,000 of the stock, roughly $20,000 in today's dollars, fell in some cases to almost nothing, while the value of $1,000 of the gold remained $1,000. That put the Federal Reserve in a tough spot. The Fed was a fairly new creation at the time. It formed in 1913, just 20 years prior. That move ceded control of U.S. money to a consortium of private bankers. It was a tough sell to the people in 1913. Part of the compromise was in limiting the Fed's ability to create money. Initially, dollars created were 40% backed by gold. The deflationary years of the Great Depression pressured the newly created Fed's dollar system. Major banks sometimes had to sell gold as there was nothing else left holding value. In a deflation, prices fall lower and lower. There is no demand for business services, and prices keep falling until buyers emerge. In the worst imaginable scenario, there are no buyers at any price. With the country mired in a deflationary spiral, FDR needed a weaker dollar. This might sound familiar as today's politicians all clamor for a weak currency. Think back to the Romans. Imagine borrowing 1,000 denarii made of silver. When the loan comes due, you pay it back with worthless coins made of bronze. For the borrower, this is a major win. For the lender, it's a big loss. Buying all the privately owned gold in the U.S. for $20.67 per ounce and immediately revaluing to $35 per ounce meant FDR effectively devalued the dollar by 69%. All it took was one executive order, a few pointed editorials from helpful members of the media, and the power to compel his citizens. At some point, today's U.S. government will face a similar dilemma. When that day comes, it's too late to prepare. Chapter 5, 1944, The Golden Rule. The person with the gold makes the rules. The same goes for countries. In 1944, leaders from 44 Allied nations gathered at a posh hotel in the mountains of New Hampshire to plot a new world monetary system. The initial meeting happened just around the time U.S. troops landed at Normandy. The U.S. entered World War II years into the fighting. Nations on both sides of the conflict drained their treasuries, borrowed from allies, and sacrificed everything before U.S. troops formally engaged. This gave the U.S. a financial upper hand in negotiating the post-war financial system. At the time, the U.S. had control of roughly 40% of total estimated world gold supplies. That was largely thanks to successfully confiscating gold from its citizens a decade prior. The New Hampshire meeting goes by the name Bretton Woods, the name of the hotel where delegates gathered. The new monetary order would effectively rid the world of any gold standard. Gold standard is frequently thrown around in conversation, and it's almost always incorrectly used. A gold standard means currency issuance ties directly to a country's gold reserves. The U.S. did at one time have such a standard. It essentially cut that standard in 1933 when FDR debased the U.S. currency by confiscating gold and forbidding private ownership in the U.S. The 1944 meeting set up the gold-to-dollar exchange, which went into place in 1945 and held until 1971. For starters, the 1944 meeting established the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, and the World Bank. Both entities would facilitate post-war rebuilding. The U.S. would have de facto control since it held the world's largest gold reserves. That gold played an important role in the plan. At the time, war-ravaged nations of the world all had their own currency, drachma, lira, dinar, franc, pound, Reichsmark, were all effectively worthless. This was long before the days of the euro. Keeping track of hundreds of weak exchange rates would be impossible as the world rebuilt. The U.S. would use its gold hoard to create an exchange standard. At any time, foreign banks, foreign governments, and certain foreign entities could present the U.S. Federal Reserve with $35 and receive 1 ounce of U.S. gold in return. This exchange standard would stabilize the currencies of the world when it came to post-war trade. Say post-war Greece and Italy needed to negotiate a trade agreement. The Greek drachma would have a quoted exchange value to dollars. The Italian lira would have one too, with the dollar as a base for establishing a trusted value for all currencies the two countries could deal. They didn't have to fear sudden devaluation altering the terms. The U.S. dollar would be the denominator of world trade. With a fixed exchange to gold at $35 an ounce, all other countries could rebuild, devalue, and organize their economies with certainty. The only catch was the U.S. would need to behave itself financially or lose its gold. Spending other people's money is easy. The 1944 Bretton Woods meeting cemented the U.S. as the world's financial anchor. This was a power almost unimaginable in history, one the U.S. managed to hold on to until 1971. Recall the terms. A foreign financial entity could exchange $35 of U.S. currency for an ounce of gold. When the agreement went into place, dollars had gold-like power. The U.S. held a controlling share of the world's physical gold. Meanwhile, U.S. citizens faced felony charges for owning gold. That meant the U.S. government had the ability to effectively control world trade without its citizens supervising. When gold trades in a free market, buyers and sellers set the price. This is called price discovery, as the free market finds the fair price. With gold pegged at a fixed price, there was no market. This amounted to unchecked power for the U.S. Slowly, the U.S. overspent. Governments can't help themselves. First millions, then billions of dollars crept overseas. The extra spending started small. For instance, the Employment Act of 1946 expanded the Fed's powers to include monitoring employment and other economic activity. While the U.S. touted free markets around the world, politicians thought it would be nice to have the central bank soften the blow if the economy ran into any trouble. Just like today, leaders promised any financial accommodation would be temporary. Next came the Korean War, which was largely under control compared to the cost of modern military action. The real trouble started after Eisenhower left office. Kennedy stepped in as the memory of the troublesome 1930s began to fade. A new generation only knew stories of the Great Depression. A compassionate U.S. government started programs to feed and care for giant swaths of its underclass. After Kennedy's death, Johnson carried on with Great Society spending programs. The country fell deeper and deeper into the Vietnam conflict. Domestic budget deficits at home and ballooning spending in Southeast Asia flooded the world with dollars. Wisely, foreign institutions gathered up those dollars, returning them to the government's gold exchange window. They'd hand over $35 for an ounce of U.S. gold. Slowly, the country's massive gold hoard dwindled. Silver supplies also dwindled. As excess dollars escaped into the world, foreigners exchanged them for U.S. silver fixed at $1.29 per ounce. Until 1964, the U.S. used silver to make its coins. Just like the Romans, they had to stop. Debase the coins. U.S. dollar coins, half dollars, quarters, and dimes contained 90% silver. Nickels of some years had 35% until 1964. With this money still tied to precious metals, foreign entities preyed on U.S. deficit spending. As it spent more and more, those dollars came back in exchange for gold and silver. The pace picked up over time. By 1964, the value of silver in U.S. coins was greater than the coin's face value. That meant the change in people's pockets was worth more as melted silver than as payment for groceries. Specifically, four quarters had a value of a dollar in the checkout line. Melting those quarters down and selling the silver content yielded more than a dollar. The consequences of borrowing beyond its means came home to roost for the U.S., but its citizens were the last to know. Foreign entities had a better view of the dollar's declining value. They quickly took advantage of the situation. The Coinage Act of 1965 put an end to this. It removed silver from dimes and quarters. It reduced silver content in half dollars to 40%. 5 years later, it took that to 0%. Most Americans did not know about the dwindling silver supplies. They also didn't care. Through those years, thousands of soldiers died in a barbaric proxy war halfway around the world. Emotions tied to Vietnam still run high. I know a local coin dealer who served, and it's a subject that can't come up. It's too bad we can't talk about Vietnam. From a monetary perspective, it's critically important. Vietnam was a trap. The U.S. stepped in the trap with one foot. Instead of cutting off the foot, the U.S. forced in the other foot. Then its hands, finally its head. To be clear, Vietnam was the end of U.S. monetary supremacy, not the cause. In 1944, the U.S. anchored the world monetary system. Discipline and absolute power don't mix well. At first, abuses are small, then they grow. The competing personalities involved have their own incentives. Excess spending becomes a one-way street. Fully entrenched in Vietnam, 25 years of foreign efforts to lure excess dollars out of the U.S. reached an extreme. Under the Bretton Woods Gold Exchange Agreement, the U.S. saw 65% of its gold fly away and never return. As the pace of gold flows ramped up, there was no choice but to end the gold-dollar exchange. Chapter 6, 1971, Nixon's Sunday Night Devaluation. On Sunday evening, August 15, 1971, President Richard Nixon officially devalued the savings and earning power of every American. It took only 18 minutes. Almost no one noticed. Of course, they heard the speech. It aired live on every major radio and television station in the country. The problem is, Nixon did a masterful job disguising the well-orchestrated devaluation from the average American. He ended the ability for foreign banks to convert dollars to gold. Until that moment, foreign banks could exchange $35 for an ounce of U.S. gold. That meant the U.S. dollar maintained a fixed value tied to the gold price. With this removed, the world would now value the dollar based on its true worth, not its convertibility to gold. Nixon knew that meant a sudden plunge in the value of the dollar. In fairness, he had no choice. The damage was done. To recap, with the Bretton Woods Agreement 26 years prior, allied nations of the world agreed to a new monetary order. The post-war world needed a stable currency system to facilitate rebuilding. The U.S. started out with a position rarely seen in world history. The post-war dollar was as good as gold. The U.S. had 60% of the world's official gold reserves at the time. That's over 22,000 metric tons. It agreed to exchange $35 for 1 ounce of that gold at any time. Only foreign banks could access this mechanism called the exchange window. Spending programs of the 1950s and 1960s pushed the federal budget into deficit. The deficit grew slowly at first, then quickly. The Vietnam War pushed deficit spending into overdrive. Deficit spending means more dollars flowing out of the treasury than tax revenue coming in to support them. Foreign governments and central banks eagerly exchanged the dollars held on their books for gold at the U.S. exchange window. When Nixon hit the airwaves that night, the massive U.S. gold hoard was 63% smaller than when the gold-to-dollar exchange agreement went into place 26 years prior. Words matter. U.S. leaders knew the dollar was in trouble. Once convertibility to gold ended, it would find its true value. That was far lower than 1/35th of an ounce of gold. Nixon had to sell this to the people. He called his speech the Challenge of Peace. He talked about soldiers unable to find work after returning from victory in Vietnam. Bringing the war up was a distraction. In reality, it raged on for at least 4 more years after the speech. Next, he talked about inflation. The Consumer Price Index, CPI, rose 6% per year for 5 years leading up to his speech. He promised to break that trend and help average people get by. He positioned himself as a hero. All good fiction needs a hero and a villain. The villain, as he told it, was a cabal of international money speculators. He made them sound terrible. They raised prices at the grocery store. They kept veterans from finding work. Neither was true. The truth was, the U.S. had an incredible power as the world's bedrock currency following the Bretton Woods Agreement. Its gold hoard underpinned this power. It abused the position by running persistent budget deficits. Foreign banks wisely swapped dollars for gold. Just as FDR disguised the 1933 devaluation by blaming it on treasonous hoarders, Nixon blamed external factors. He pretended to stand up for hard-working Americans. In both cases, 1933 and 1971, U.S. leaders abused the nation's money for years before sticking the bill on its citizens. The actual devaluations were inevitable. What devaluations look like. Over halfway through the speech, Nixon said, "I want to lay to rest this bugaboo called devaluation." He knew what was about to happen to the average American's wealth. Here's what it looked like over time. A chart of the dollar's value against currencies of other nations shows that its value fell for months leading up to Nixon's official announcement. Recall that Nixon said the evil speculators relentlessly attacked the dollar in the weeks prior to his speech. We can only assume that U.S. deficit spending hit a level so extreme, foreign governments lost confidence. There was a rush to grab U.S. gold. The door to the now much smaller U.S. gold vault closed after his speech. With the dollar peg to gold officially removed, the value of the U.S. currency fell precipitously against those of other nations. Lucky for Nixon, people don't understand currencies. In March 2016, I took my sister on a ski trip to Switzerland. She's easy to travel with and wanted to see what it was like to ski on real mountains. We started out at St. Moritz. At lunch on day two, I said, "This afternoon, we're both going to buy a Rolex." My sister wasn't interested. She didn't care for watches. She's also, wisely, quite frugal. I took her to the store anyway. On the way, I explained the Swiss franc was near parity with the U.S. dollar. The summer prior, it was 10% higher. When I visited in 2011, it was 25% higher. She still didn't quite understand my enthusiasm. Instead of teaching her about the value of currencies, I'd let her learn. She picked out a nice watch. Priced in Swiss francs, we calculated the conversion rate to dollars. She'd pay about $4,000 for the watch. I told her to go outside and call the Rolex dealer at the local mall in Florida. Tell them she's looking for a price quote on the exact model. Don't bother mentioning she's in Switzerland. She came back in the store and told me, "You won't believe it. This watch is $5,000 in Florida." Rolex prices watches using the manufacturer's suggested retail price, MSRP. That means it sets the watch price for a period of time and doesn't make a lot of changes. My hunch was, with the value of the franc down, our dollars would buy more watch than even 1 year prior. That turned out to be true. I bought a watch too. My price was 19% less than I'd pay back in Florida. My point here is, most people don't understand how the value of currencies fluctuate. If you're only spending dollars, you never leave the U.S. and don't plan to consume any products from abroad, you'll never notice a currency devaluation. If you're one of those people. In his devaluation speech, Nixon made reference to those people. He chided those who might want to buy a foreign car or take a trip to London. This is a classic tactic in class warfare. It's an attempt to pit the masses against the wealthy minority. He's insinuating the housewife battling grocery inflation has it tough because the corporate executive wants to take his wife to Wimbledon. In reality, the two have nothing to do with one another. In fact, the corporate executive could have and should have changed as many dollars as possible while overseas during the years leading up to Nixon's 1971 devaluation. To any thinking person, the devaluation was obvious. Fortunately for Nixon and other politicians, the ranks of the thinking are thin. To shield the public from watching their dollar tumble in value, he asked Congress to impose several distractions. First, he asked for a 10% tariff on all imported foreign goods. He said this would protect the American worker from international evils. The truth is, it masked part of the dollar's 25% tumble between 1970 and 1973. Tariffs and taxes on imported goods are a political tool to obscure their changing value. Second, he proposed a freeze on all price increases for 90 days. Nothing obscures the free market price like making something illegal. This bought him a few months of political reprieve. Businesses could cushion the blow as the dollar tumbled. Remember, raw materials like copper, oil, gold, and anything used by every country trade on a world market. Regardless of currency, buyers must pay the going rate to get these materials. While Nixon stopped the price of butter from rising, he couldn't hold back the built-up inflationary tidal wave. Years in the making, it was about to destroy the U.S., turning the 1970s into a tumultuous decade for unprepared dollar holders. Chapter 7. 1970 to 1979, gold gains 1,365%. The U.S. dollar lost its tether to gold in August 1971. Nixon scrambled to enact laws preventing Americans from seeing the dollar's true value. Meanwhile, it was still a felony for U.S. citizens to own gold. Gold has a special value. It's immune from the devaluation tactics that plague government-issued money. Gold can sit at the bottom of the ocean for millennia. Pull it up, dry it off, and every molecule of gold is still intact. Physically speaking, gold has integrity. It keeps its shape during a 1,000-degree house fire. To melt it, you'll need 1,948 degrees of heat. While its shape will change, its weight does not. That means its real value stays intact. Theft and government seizure are the only true perils for gold. FDR's gold seizure in 1933 made possessing it a felony. As the dollar tumbled in value during the early 1970s, informed Americans started asking questions. A New Orleans-based gold advocate named Jim Blanchard organized a gold legalization movement. He hired a plane to fly a giant banner over Richard Nixon's January 1973 inauguration. What Blanchard and others realized was keeping gold illegal kept Americans in the dark about the real value of their dollars. Again, if you don't travel, don't buy international goods, and don't deal in international commodities, you probably won't notice a currency devaluation until it's too late. In the 1970s, that's just what the U.S. government wanted. The scramble to find cheaper imports. 6 months after Nixon cut the dollar's peg to gold, he flew to China. This was a historic visit. He made sure to get the most out of photos and media coverage of his diplomatic mission. On the surface, Nixon would improve world relations. He reestablished ties with China after decades of tension. The truth about this trip was Nixon knew opening China was the only way to soften the blow of dollar weakness. When I say Nixon, I don't mean he himself thought this up. U.S. presidents don't have the power most people assume they do. There are competing forces pushing and clawing for advantage in the U.S. The same goes for all nations. This is the nature of things. It's no different from 10 puppies fighting over 8 teats. The U.S. standard of living was in trouble in the 70s. 3 decades of overspending caught up to the average American in an instant. To mask the problem, it needed cheaper access to consumer goods and energy. China could solve the first problem. Mao Zedong had a giant nation fully under his thumb. U.S. media outlets largely ignored his murderous grip on power. Mao murdered by the thousands. The State Department issued a friendly estimate of Mao's killing spree at 800,000 victims. He himself guessed he killed 700,000 of his own citizens. Outside accounts were closer to 1.5 million people. Mass murder, genocide, and human rights only matter to the U.S. when there are political benefits on the line. They go right under the rug when it needs something else. In this case, it needed a giant factory to produce cheap goods in exchange for weak U.S. dollars in the years to come. China was in. Gold becomes legal. Nixon left office in August 1974. It was almost 3 years from the day he cut the dollar's link to gold. President Gerald Ford took office on August 9, 1974. Just 6 days later, he signed Public Law 93-373, making gold ownership legal for American citizens. The law went into effect on December 31st of that year. After 41 years of carrying a felony charge for ownership, U.S. citizens could once again own gold. Law-abiding Americans missed out on the first few years of the gold rally. When Nixon removed the peg in 1971, gold was $35 an ounce. The day it became legal to own, it sold for $183.85 an ounce. The rumor of legalization sent gold prices soaring in advance of the new law. That's common in markets. The rumor of a policy change can send prices soaring higher than the news of the change itself. Illegal for 41 years, most people in the U.S. didn't understand gold. It seemed like something a country would own. The idea that anyone would need it to protect their wealth didn't register. By the end of the decade, everyone would understand the value of gold. After initially shooting up 400% between 1971 and legalization in 1974, gold settled down. It drifted slowly lower for about 18 months. This was the time to buy. In the late years of the 1970s, it would go on an epic run, topping out at $850 in January of 1980. Bottom to top, that marked a 23-fold increase from its formerly fixed value of $35 an ounce. Gold mining stocks ran even more. For decades, companies producing gold sold it into a fixed market. Towards the end of the gold-dollar exchange, gold mining was a tough business. costs rose faster than revenue due to the fixed price. That changed as the gold price took off. Long-life mines sold output for a multiple of initial projections. Imagine what would happen to your business if you raised prices by more than 20 times, and the only consequence was customer interest tripled. That's what happened to gold miners in the late 1970s. We're about to experience something similar today. There's the bottom, then the test. George Soros has a famous quote about markets that says, "There's the bottom, then the test." I flew to the Bahamas in January 2020 to meet with a famous investor. He's an unrivaled thinker, market strategist, and gentleman. We dined at his palatial home where we talked about gold. We both felt that gold looked set to explode in price. Our estimate turned out to be right. That said, there's a long way to go. My host reminded me of what George Soros said about markets and how it relates to certain times in the gold market. The bottom is hard to pick. Only a daredevil tries to nail it exactly. For gold in the 1970s, it was the period between 1971 and legalization in 1974. Then, there's the test. People who got the gold story right in 1974 faced a test. They got the big picture right buying gold. By the end of the decade, they'd see much higher prices. But first, they'd endure 18 months where the price drifted lower before taking off. The test is always painful. Many people can't handle it. They sell, walk away, and try to forget about the idea entirely. The more intense the test, the more spectacular the rally. The reward comes to those who get it right and have patience. After becoming legal in 1974, gold fell 44% through August 1976. Owners who held the newly legal metal questioned their thinking. Those who survived the test went on to see a 721% rally in the 3.5 years that followed. We're in a similar period today. Gold hit an all-time high of $1,900 an ounce in September 2011. It spent the next 4 years slowly falling. In December 2015, it hit a low of $1,050 an ounce. That was a long and painful test. In the 3 years that followed the December 2015 bottom, it ran quietly without much notice. In December 2018, major gold dealer Kitco Metals interviewed me on the subject. Gold set right around $1,250 an ounce at the time. I told the host gold looked set to breach $1,500 an ounce the following year. It hit that mark less than 8 months later. That was a more than 20% advance that was barely noticed by the mainstream financial news. I went back on the same Kitco program, calling for $1,900 an ounce in 2020. 3 months in, gold topped $1,700 an ounce, again, with little mainstream attention. What I hope you see by the end of this book is it's merely the warm-up phase of the current gold bull market. It has a lot further to run. Just as in 1971, a devaluation is on the horizon. Investors who see that now, in advance of the official news, stand the chance to earn substantial profits. More importantly, they'll preserve their hard-earned wealth. Chapter 8, 1985, The Plaza Hotel Fix. In late 2016, I flew to North Carolina to meet with a former top executive of BB&T Bank, now Truist Financial. He teaches a class at a local business school. He climbed the ranks at BB&T when its headquarters was in Wilson, North Carolina. That's where I grew up. In fact, I carpooled to grade school with his kids. My grandfather sat on the bank's board for years. He thought highly of the group chosen to run things when he and his peers retired. They went on to multiply the size of what had been a small North Carolina bank. Wilson is a small tobacco town, about 1 hour east of Raleigh, the state capital. The bank left in the mid-90s. The tobacco market did too. Today, it's essentially impoverished. The group that transformed the bank into a major institution wasn't what you'd expect. Knowing them well, it's fair to say they were more libertarian-minded than their peers. During our meeting, I brought up gold. It was $1,250 an ounce at the time. We were about to form Metallo Royalty and Streaming in what I felt was a once-in-a-lifetime chance to acquire royalties on future gold production. I wanted to test my thinking on someone with a storied banking career. I laid out what I saw coming for the financial system, the incentives in place, and how I expected they'd shape the future. To me, the course looked inevitable. If that's how it played out, gold would be an essential investment. To assure me I wasn't far off, he told me a story about dealing with banking regulators. They're testy, by-the-book types. They'd visit the bank routinely to look over its financials. During one visit, he asked the regulator, "Why doesn't the government fix the price of oranges?" The regulator snapped back, instantly telling him we'd never allow that in the U.S. because this is a free market. That's why the country is so powerful, so filled with opportunity. My host replied, well, why do you, the Fed, fix the price of money? He only did this once. While I thought this was a brilliant question, he said it didn't go over well. The sentries who polish the facade of the U.S. financial system don't take kindly to intellectual sparring. Obviously, fixing the price of oranges would reward bad producers and punish premium producers. Say the fixed price was $1 per pound. Growers of subpar orange crops that normally sold for 75 cents a pound get a profit boost. Meanwhile, growers of premium oranges that once sold for $1.25 a pound would take a crippling loss. The incentives in this case reward growers who produce the cheapest crop possible. Over time, you'd see a black market for quality oranges emerge. That underground black market would be a true free market, with prices set by buyers willing to pay up for quality. The question my friend asked his regulator that day has important philosophical meaning. Understanding what this means will help you see what's ahead for today's monetary system, which is no longer a free market. Price fixing is exactly what governments do with their money. The U.S. is the worst offender. How to spot what's ahead? When Nixon ended dollar convertibility to gold in August 1971, the damage was already done. Waiting any longer would have emptied the U.S. gold vault entirely. People paying attention in the years leading up to his speech expected this, or something similar. It's difficult to predict exactly when this type of event will happen in the markets, but how it will happen is a bit easier. After Nixon's 1971 speech, the dollar lost 23% of its value against rival currencies. That planted the seeds of radical price inflation, energy market instability, and general economic malaise that turned up later in the decade. That's the trick to getting in front of a major market move. If you can see the seeds planted, you'll know in advance where to look for the mature plants. By the end of the 1970s, the average American stood by, bamboozled at the sight of gas lines, shortages, and sky-high interest rates. Gold, the only protection against circumstances like these, topped out at $850 an ounce the day after Reagan's 1980 inauguration. By then, it was too late to seek shelter from the economic storm. People tend to base their thoughts about the economic future on what just happened. They're somehow unable to see the early stages of change and consider what's ahead. In 1971, they didn't see the tumultuous decade ahead. In 1980, they felt the turmoil would never end. Both times, they got it wrong. I know this firsthand. I have two very smart friends in their early 70s. Both are renowned investors. They don't know each other personally, but both were up-and-coming financial analysts during the late 1970s. The first, Doug Casey, wrote a book called Crisis Investing. The theme was the radical inflation and economic turmoil of the 1970s was just the tip of the iceberg. Crisis Investing was a New York Times bestseller. Doug appeared on many major television and radio programs. While the book is incredibly insightful, his general premise did not play out in the following years. At almost the exact same time, unbeknownst to Casey, Kirill Sokoloff and A. Gary Schilling wrote a book titled Inflation is Ending, Are You Ready? The book proposed the turmoil of the 1970s was effectively over. Stocks would surge after a decade of literally going nowhere. Interest rates would fall from 15% to far lower levels. While deadly accurate, this book sold far fewer copies. The public preferred a book predicting more of the same ahead. Part of what Sokoloff and Schilling realized was that structural changes, like the 1979 appointment of Paul Volcker to Fed chairman, were major turning points. For instance, Volcker took steps to break the back of inflation. This meant gold, commodities, and hard asset investing had run its course. It was time to buy what nobody wanted: stocks, bonds, and assets that benefit from a stronger U.S. dollar. The reforms of the late 1970s were lost on the average American. It was too late to profit once they finally noticed. They piled into gold and silver and anything that promised protection from a falling dollar and high inflation. Already visible on the horizon, they could not see a major change ahead. Strong, but not too strong. By 1981, things turned around for the beleaguered U.S. dollar. High interest rates broke the back of inflation. Borrowing costs peaked and began to fall. By 1982, the bottom was in for stocks. Assets that suffered in the prior decade started moving higher. Midway through the decade, the dollar doubled from its late 1970s low. People finally dumped inflation protection assets for big losses, jumping back into the dollar. They now wanted a piece of the booming economy of the 1980s. Trips overseas, barely affordable for the wealthy 5 years ago, were cheap. The dollar had incredible value against other currencies. Then, on September 22, 1985, representatives from the five largest economies at the time met at the Plaza Hotel on the southeast corner of Central Park in New York City. They agreed the dollar was too strong. They planned a coordinated effort to reduce its value. It was the second devaluation in 15 years. By New Year's Eve 1987, the value of the dollar was back where it started the decade. A strong dollar means its value towers over trading partners. Trips abroad, luxury imports, and a high standard of living for people with money are common with a strong dollar. However, the strong dollar makes U.S. exports expensive to overseas importers. It's similar to my 2016 trip to Switzerland, when the dollar gained on the Swiss franc. I took advantage by buying a Swiss watch priced in francs. The exchange worked to my advantage. My dollars had greater value. At the same time, if a Swiss citizen flew to Aspen, Colorado for a ski trip, it would seem more expensive. The truth today is, no country wants a strong currency. It's easy to see by scanning financial headlines. You'll notice governments accusing each other of manipulating currency values. None of them want to let the free market work. Anyone serious about preserving wealth must own assets immune to this government roller coaster. If the free market reigned, savers and investors would set the fair value of currencies. Undervalued countries would see a surge in international attention. For instance, if the Swiss franc fell too much, U.S. skiers would flock to the Alps. Politicians won't allow the free market to work. They can't bear the social backlash that comes from a groaning public unaware of market trends. The banking regulator said it best when asked why the government wouldn't fix the price of oranges. The free market naturally puts a premium on quality and a discount on junk. However, he missed the point of the question. The government does tremendous damage by fixing the price of money and credit. Chapter 9, The Inevitable Devaluation. The evidence is clear. Governments spend money they don't have. When the bill comes due, they devalue their currencies to pay for it. It's a trend stretching back thousands of years. For governments, the power to tax is paramount. Pay your taxes or go to jail. Taxes start small. In the U.S., there was no income tax until 1913. The law met heavy resistance. It took 4 years to ratify. What starts small grows, 0.5%, then 1, 2, 10, and finally, no amount is enough. The government always needs more to get the job done. It rarely spends that money wisely. In 2019, the U.S. collected $3.46 trillion in taxes. That's over 16% of its GDP. It spent almost $1 trillion more than it collected in taxes. Borrowed money made up the difference. Our concern, as wealth builders bound to the government's money system, is not bankruptcy. That's rare. A government like the U.S. can borrow to fund its ballooning budget for years to come. In fact, as long as it can compel the world to accept dollars, there's no limit to its spending addiction. It's the value of the dollars we earn, save, and invest that deserves concern. All we have to do is look back to the value of a dollar in 1900.